Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh, copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh, and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. Today we're beginning episode 17, the final episode, on page 236 of this 247-page book. In episode 16, Ambrose's daughters from his second marriage, Kathy and Donnie, visited their half-brothers Ron and Bill in New Hampshire. They shared memories and celebrated Ron's 68th birthday, along with Ron's wife, Barbara, her five sisters, and many more. Then Barbara caught us up on the Newfoundland tragedy's aftermath. She told what happened to many of the children in the story in 1935. Father McGettigan served other communities after Marystown and finally retired to St. John's with his memories. Now, episode 17. Chapter 32, One Last Journey, Brooklyn and Staten Island, October 2006. My father walks along the Brooklyn Pier. The October wind is brisk off the New York Harbor. Whitecaps dance on the gray-green water. Decades past, a wooden wharf stood here, the pier where my grandfather awaited the Staten Island ferry on an August afternoon in 1935. Somewhere nearby, in the waterfront neighborhoods of Brooklyn, Ambrose sat on a bench, eating his lunch as a breeze carried a newspaper to his feet. I imagine the terror that gripped my grandfather as he read the New York newspaper headline, "August Gale Kills More Than 40 Newfoundland Fishermen." Scanning the story further, he found the words that caused him to cry out. The hurricane that roared across Newfoundland over the weekend swept away 40 lives, tragedy concentrated in some cases on individual families. Captain Patrick Walsh and his son were found dead aboard the Annie Anita when she drifted into Hazel Cove on her beam ends. Six other men and another of Walsh's sons were listed in her crew, and they were almost surely drowned. That was only part of the Walsh family tragedy, however. Captain Walsh's eldest son was skipper of the schooner Mary Bernice. Today the vessel was found drifting bottom up in Placentia Bay, her crew missing. Along this gritty waterfront, my grandfather sat alone, collapsed in grief, sobbing for the death of his hero, Paddy, and his three nephews, James, Jerome, and Frankie. Distraught, he made his way here to the 69th Street Wharf, to await the ferry home to his wife Patricia and his newborn son Ronald. The news of the tragedy broke something deep inside my grandfather. He went berserk, a relative told me, screaming and shouting. He totally lost it. 5 years have passed since my father shared the story of the August Gale with me. Here on this pier, a sudden and persistent breeze carried the prophetic newspaper to my grandfather's feet. What if that story had not been remembered, retold decades later by my father, voiced to me on a winter night? Would my grandfather have remained a stranger, my father's childhood a mystery? On the horizon, the Statue of Liberty rises up toward the blue October sky. My father gazes across the bay to Staten Island. His story began here, too. His memories, the good and the bad, resonate here. Surprisingly, it was my father's idea to visit the homes, neighborhoods, and churches of his childhood. "I thought it might be good for you to see them," he tells me. My two younger sisters, the twins, Janice and Joan, and my mother, decide to accompany us. They realize this is a once-in-a-lifetime trip, and they do not want to miss it. Yet this sojourn, like our Newfoundland journey, has triggered yet a new round of emotions in each of us. The night before we drive to New York, my dad reminisces about his younger years. The story of Ambrose's deadly street fight in Bay Ridge stands out in his mind. Ironically, it is one of my father's good memories. At the time, in 1942, my Nana, father, and Ambrose lived in Bay Ridge, in one of the many apartments they rented during the post-Depression years. On the day of the fight, my father is 7 years old and sent to buy milk at the local market. The dark-haired boy runs along 69th Street. The grocery is a couple of blocks away from his family's home. He eyes the candy shelves as he enters the store, wishing he had a few spare pennies. He grabs the milk and pays for his purchase. Sprinting from the store, he races down the sidewalk. Up ahead, the entry to a Greek restaurant's cellar storage is open. The boy doesn't see the metal door, and his foot catches its edge, causing him to trip. The milk bottles shatter, scattering dozens of shards. He falls, his hands splayed out in front of him. Before he gets up, he worries about the milk that pools on the sidewalk, and then he notices the blood that runs down his left hand like a little river. "He needs 7 stitches," the doctor later tells Ambrose. "You need to take him to the hospital for ether." "He doesn't need ether," Ambrose says. "Stitch him up here." The boy winces but says nothing. He knows his father doesn't like crying or weak men. In Newfoundland, Ambrose grew up without painkillers or hospitals. Ronnie falls quiet as he watches the doctor thread a large needle that reminds the boy of a fish hook. The doctor pulls the needle in and out of the boy's hand 6 times. The child has never felt pain like this. But he sighs now, thinking it is over. The doctor eyes his work. "We need 1 more," he says. This stitch would hurt more than the first 6. Still, he does not cry. Later, Ambrose takes his son home and leaves to confront the Greek restaurant owner whose open sidewalk vault caused the accident. "You hurt my son," he yells at the owner. "You need to pay for his doctor's bill." Affronted over the accusation and this brazen, dark-eyed man, the owner hollers, "Get out!" When Ambrose refuses to leave, the owner grabs a butcher knife and chases him into the street. There is shouting, screaming. Strangers stop to stare at the man who shakes the silver knife in the afternoon air. Ambrose eyes the blade. He could outrun this man, but he does not. During the Depression, he fought as a middleweight to earn extra money, and like his brother Paddy, he refuses to back down from a challenge. He punches the restaurant owner in the head as the knife is raised. The man falls to the street, and his skull strikes the curb with a loud crack. The wail of ambulance and police sirens grow closer, and soon the dead body and Ambrose are taken away. Days later, a judge frees Ambrose, ruling that the lethal punch was thrown in self-defense. As my father retells this story, the details that linger in his memory are not the fight or a man's death, but the 7 stitches and Ambrose's pride. "He was so proud I didn't cry," my father tells us. Ambrose's son had suffered like a man. He bragged about his boy at poker games and to relatives. My father will carry those words, Ambrose's love and respect, close to his heart for the next 6 decades. Absent-mindedly on this October evening, my father rubs the scar. The gash on his left hand is faded now, the crescent moon mark barely visible. The sun dips below the trees outside as my 2 younger sisters and I try to visualize Ambrose, his bravado, his pride for our father. Would we have grown close to our grandfather, forgiven him if we had had the chance? "I don't know if I would have liked him," Janice says. "I probably would have hugged him if I met him," Joni adds. My father shakes his head at the thought of his daughter embracing Ambrose. "He's still my grandfather, our blood," Joni says. "He had to live with the guilt." The conversation pauses as my father tries to explain his animosity, the memories of his mother who struggled to feed and clothe her 2 sons. One vision continues to haunt him, the image of his mother bent over a sink, scrubbing dirty pans in the back room of a restaurant. "Every night, Billy and I had to sit at the counter and eat our dinners there while she washed dishes," my father says, his voice breaking. "It was painful as hell." The memory ends there. My father wipes tears that we have never seen before. "I'm sorry all this happened to you, Dad," Janice says. She, too, is now crying. The room is still. My sisters and I are beginning to realize how much hurt lingers. My mother sits quietly by my side. She, more than any of us, knows how long my father has buried his feelings. For most of my parents' marriage, my father refused to talk about Ambrose or his childhood memories. "It has affected him his whole life," she has told me. When she met my father in 1956, she was a raven-haired, striking young woman working as a secretary at the Raytheon Company in Bedford, Massachusetts. One of her jobs was collecting time cards, and the dark-eyed young man who stocked the shelves immediately caught her eye. We just looked at each other, and it was love at first sight. Just out of the Navy, my father's confidence and good looks enamored the young woman from Lowell, Massachusetts. My mother's laughter and bright eyes captivated my father. Within a year they were married, in February 1957, at a wedding in which the guests were told Ambrose was dead. "I don't want to talk about him," my father explained to my mother. "I don't want to hear his name." For the next 49 years of their marriage, my mother respected her husband's request, and now on this fall evening she is keenly aware of how far my father has come in sharing, relieving the burden he has carried for decades. The following morning is cold, brisk, and the October breeze swirls leaves into the air as we walk along Brooklyn's 69th Street. My father searches for the street door that tripped him and prompted the deadly brawl. "I want to show you where the fight was," he says. Hands stuffed into his khakis, he looks for the familiar details of his childhood. Much is different now. He does not recognize the apartments built over the years. Tall buildings replace the vacant lots where boys tossed balls. The stores and restaurants have changed hands and names. Yet there are two crimson metal doors. My father walks to them, trying to remember. He stops to stare at the two sheets of metal pressed into the sidewalk. Could this be the street vault he tripped over as a small boy? Inside the nearby deli, a young man in a baseball cap pours coffee. A middle-aged man stands behind the counter. "Excuse me," my father says. "I used to live here more than 60 years ago. Do you know if a Greek restaurant used to be here back in the 1940s? The two men cannot help my father recreate his past. They do not know if this deli was a Greek restaurant years ago. Still, there are the crimson metal doors outside. We step back outside and stare at them again. I see my father, a small boy, running down this street, two milk bottles in his hands. I hear glass shattering and the sound of a boy's surprised cry as he eyes the blood running down his palm. "This must be it," my father says, staring at the doors, lost in his reverie of the past. As we drive away from the street with the crimson gates, away from the water, I consider my father's scar, a symbol of his lesson learned as a child, the tender palm of a boy stitched together with a needle large and shaped like a fishhook. Ambrose knew that his son had to endure, to accept pain. He had witnessed many a Newfoundland fisherman, his own brother Paddy, suffer through festering fishhook wounds, wrists swollen and blistered from the salty sea. Pain is being lost in your dory on the Grand Banks, with nothing to eat, and your hands bleeding from pulling on the oars day and night in the cold curtains of fog. Pain is drowning in the sea, with a gale roaring overhead, a gale that you know will take you and your three sons to a watery grave. Pain is part of life, boy. At sea, Ambrose knew there were no doctors, no quick cures for infection. The Newfoundland fishermen had their own ways of dealing with pain. Afflicted with a fishhook in their hand, the superstitious and religious dorymen often pressed the hook 3 times into their wound, 3 times in honor of the Holy Trinity, 3 times to heal. Unknowingly, my father carries out his own ritual. Often he presses his fingers into his palm, absent-mindedly rubbing the scar, touching the wound to remember. It taught me a great lesson. It toughened me up, taught me how to tolerate pain. Ironically, the man who taught him the lesson would later provoke the deepest hurt. The afternoon sun loses its warmth, and the light fades behind the tall buildings as we hunt for one more church, one more apartment, and the last place my father lived in Brooklyn. After getting lost for 2 hours, which exasperates all of us, and stirs several Jesus Christs from my father, we park alongside the Visitation of the Blessed Virgin Mary Church in Red Hook. The church and its presbytery are mammoth, intimidating gray Gothic buildings that span the block. The steeple and bell tower loom over the treetops and a nearby park, an icon that once drew the families of Irish and Italian fishermen to Mass. My father climbs the 20 steps to the rectory and rings the buzzer. From the sidewalk he appears small, dwarfed by the towering church walls, the large double doors of glass and wood. A priest answers on the intercom. "Hello, Father. I was an altar boy here 60 years ago. I'd like to talk to somebody and see the church." Minutes later, the priest answers the door with a smile and welcomes us inside. Father Carlos Valencia is slim, dark-haired, and young. He is eager to help, and he offers us a tour before the Saturday evening Mass begins. The church was built by Irish fishermen, he tells us, the cavernous ceiling constructed to resemble the hull of Noah's Ark. I eye the church's ceiling and think of wooden schooners, of Paddy Walsh and the August Gale. My Nana sat in one of the oak pews here, rosary beads in her hand, a beret on her head. She came here often to pray and watch her son perform his duties on the altar. My grandfather did not join her. He came here once to see me, my father remembers, his voice soft and low. At the front of the church, to the left and right of the altar, small red votive candles flicker. Nana often took my sisters and me inside churches to light these candles. She slipped quarters inside the metal boxes and lit the tiny flames, praying silently for her sons, her grandchildren, and for Ambrose. A statue of the Blessed Mary hovers near the candles. A blue cloth cloaks her head. Her face radiates peace, forgiveness. I think of Nana's soft cheeks, her kind blue eyes. She forgave Ambrose after all his hurt, horrible choices and betrayals. She forgave him. She prayed for him, wrote him letters, and kept him informed about his sons, his grandchildren. She forgave. Sunlight filters from the stained glass windows, illuminating a row of pews. I sit down in one of them and close my eyes. I make a mental list of the good in my grandfather. The years he supervised 50 men at the ship-rigging loft during the war. The afternoons he played catch with my father and taught him how to ride a bike. The years that he provided for his family, was a loving father, a loyal husband. I will never understand what you did, but you are my family, my grandfather. You are my father's father, a part of him and a part of me. At the back of the church, I hear my father's voice. He is talking to a few older women who were born in Red Hook and have belonged to the church since they were small girls. My father tells them he served as an altar boy in the church on Sundays and lived on Columbia Avenue in a three-story apartment building. A synagogue occupied half the building's first floor. The women nod, remembering. My father doesn't tell them that this is the home where Ambrose abandoned him, the apartment where he remembers eating onion sandwiches for dinner, where rats scrambled in the stairways, and the mafia ruled the poverty-riddled streets. The women give my father directions to his old apartment, and we step out into the street. Birds swoop in the trees as my father strolls past the park, where he played baseball many years ago. His head is bent against the wind as he walks along the brick sidewalk that leads to Columbia Avenue. Hip-hop music blares from a parked car as he crosses the street. Tattered chairs lean against a sidewalk bar. He eyes the deli on the corner and remembers a store where his mother sent him for groceries. Many times he paid with food vouchers, charity from the church. He remembers the Italian parades that wound their way along this street and the Italian kids who dominated the neighborhood. Here he had his share of fights. The Italian kids called him Irish. Somewhere on this street, my uncle, a toddler at the time, tossed my father's new shoes onto the sidewalk from their window. They were stolen by the time my father ran down the two flights of stairs to fetch them. Continuing to the end of Columbia Street, my father shakes his head. The apartment building he once lived in is gone. It must have been torn down, he says, disappointed, still looking for something familiar, a street corner, a store. I envision my grandfather carefully closing an apartment door, a shadow in the dark. Quietly he slips into his sister-in-law's car and drives away, stealing the car and $800 in cash, advance money for a paint job he would never do. Inside, his two sons and his wife sleep. The streets are quiet as Ambrose leaves, the car disappearing, turning away from Columbia Avenue. Now, on this October afternoon, I am glad we cannot find this home. I do not like to think of my father alone here, an 11-year-old left to look after his mother and year-old brother, a boy left to wonder where his father went and why. Like the bulldozer that tore down my father's old home, I wish I could destroy these memories, the ill-fated trip to San Francisco, and the night Ambrose disappeared from this street. But as with the August Gale children, the past remains present for my father. It is his to keep, his to remember, his to forgive or forget. Not long after we return home, my father reflects on why he kept his childhood memories buried, concealed from me, my sisters, and mother. On the phone, he apologizes to me one evening. "I kept this all inside me in the form of bitterness. I was wrong to keep it from you all. I just wanted to push those memories out of my life. I guess I was selfish. I don't know. I didn't want to burden you kids or your mother with this stuff. I didn't want you to think I wanted any sympathy or anything." "It's okay," I tell my father. "We know the stories now." My father sighs and falls quiet. "I love you, Dad," I tell him, my voice cracking with the weight of my words. "I love you too," he says. Months after our journey to Staten Island in Brooklyn, I find a picture taken during one of my father's birthdays. My father, uncle, and Nana gather around our backyard picnic table. A birthday cake with strawberries and whipped cream rests before them. My uncle sits in the middle, and his arms are wrapped around the shoulders of his mother and brother. He is a father himself now, with a son and daughter, and a loyal wife, a successful job overseeing a mental health agency in Michigan. He grins into the camera, and it is clear he is so happy to be among his family. "Happy birthday, big brother. You were always looking after me, steering me in the right direction. And, Ma, you sure took care of us through thick and thin. We were blessed to have your love and strength." Nana is in her early 70s, confident in who she is, a mother, a grandmother, a woman well-loved by her grandchildren and sons. She gazes toward the camera lens with a hint of a smile, and there is resoluteness in her blue eyes. "These are my boys, Ronnie and Billy. They turned out pretty good. We all came out pretty good." On the other end of the table, my father's arm rests against his younger brother's back. His lips are pressed together in a smile, and his brown eyes shine. I have seen this expression many times before when he has attended the honor roll dinners, award ceremonies, and college graduations of his six daughters. Pride and love well up in his face on this summer afternoon. "My mother is something else. She worked so hard and went through tough times to keep us together, to raise us right. We each could have taken some bad turns, but we stuck together, and that made all the difference." I consider the turmoil, the internal storms they each weathered, how this picture, their lives, might have turned out differently. Both my father and uncle could have taken darker, destructive paths, but my Nana held them close, and they watched out for each other. 10 years younger than his older brother, my uncle looked to my dad for advice and support, once even giving him a Father's Day gift to show his appreciation. "Your dad was the male role model in my life," my uncle tells me. "He taught me how to be a good father." Throughout my childhood, my father espoused many rules and offered many pieces of advice to my sisters and me. But there is one saying that resonates. Whenever my sisters and I battled, or we strayed too far from home in our travels or jobs, he would tell us, "Always remember that blood is thicker than water." There was nothing more vital, even after his father twice abandoned him, than family. His mother and brother remained the center, the heart of his young life. Years later, my sisters, mother, and I would further cement his belief that there is nothing, nothing more important than your family. For as long as I can remember, my father has encouraged, cheered, and guided us all. Through the bad dreams, the disappointments, the milestones, the baptisms, the weddings, and the bumps in the road, he has always been there for his family, for me, for my sisters, and for my mother. His strong arms have always held us close, and I have always known that he would never, ever let us go. This is where the main story ends in August Gale by Barbara Walsh. Next, she includes acknowledgments, a few of which I'll read here. Like my great-uncle Patty, who gathered a strong and seasoned crew for the Annie Anita and Mary Bernice, I was fortunate to have my own team of friends, family, and experts to guide and encourage me through to the completion of August Gale. To Con Fitzpatrick, a volunteer at the Marystown Heritage Museum and co-author of A History of Marystown, Mortier Bay, who eagerly shared his knowledge of his town, its history, and its seafaring culture. Extraordinary thanks to Ralph Getson, curator of education at the Fisheries Museum of the Atlantic in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia, for his patience, wisdom, and kindness over the past year while he taught a landlubber about schooners, dories, and the salt cod fishery. to Captains Alex Green and George Pike, savvy and skilled Newfoundland and Nova Scotia fishermen, who taught me how to row a dory, despite the fact I had dogfish strokes, and offered crucial insight into the mindset of skippers and dorymen. They ensured that my details about hauling trawl, sailing the sea, and battling gales were accurate and true. After acknowledgments, a glossary, and several maps, Barbara includes, on page 259, the words to the Walsh Tragedy Song by Joseph Murray. In 1935, on August 21, two fishing boats went out to sea from the port of Marystown, headed for the Grand Banks, Cape St. Mary's fishing grounds. Among the 14 men who sailed were a father and three sons. The skies and sea were calm and clear till August 25th, when a big nor'easter came ashore, setting wharves and boats adrift, uprooting trees and houses along the coast of Newfoundland, while out at sea two fishing boats were filling up with sand. Chorus. As the wind screamed through the rigging and the waves rose mountains high, those brave men fought the hurricane and prayed to God on high. The ocean is a graveyard when those storms are at their height. 14 people lost at sea on that dark and stormy night. Narrative. Paddy Walsh was skipper of the Annie Anita, while eldest son Jimmy skippered the Mary Bernice. Other members of that ill-fated crew were John Brinton, Edward Clark, Dominic Walsh, George Mitchell, Richard and Charles Hanrahan, Dennis Long, Michael Farrell, Tom and Billy Reed. Also on board were Paddy Walsh's 12 and 14-year-old sons, Francis and Jerome. As the thunder rolled and the lightning flashed across the banks of Newfoundland, as waves crashed down upon the heads of that gallant little band, a baby girl named Jamie was born that night to Jimmy Walsh's wife, as her father fought the raging storm that finally took his life. When the dawn broke clear and bright next day across the fishing grounds, no sign of the two small boats could anywhere be found, till a wreck washed up on St. Shot's Beach, half filled up with sand. The only sign of human life was a small boy's little hand. Chorus. Church bells rang out in Marystown as the news spread far and wide. Prayers and masses for the dead, for the 14 souls who died. Mothers wept and widows grieved, while children tried to understand how God in all his mercy had forsaken those brave men. The memory of that awful night back in 35 still haunts the hearts and minds of those who are still alive. When the August gales each summer cross the banks of Newfoundland, they kneel and pray to God above, safeguard our fishermen. Chorus. A short note about the author. Barbara Walsh is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and magazine columnist who has chased many stories during her career. Her work has changed lives, laws, and affected the 1988 presidential election. She is the author of Sammy in the Sky, a children's book illustrated by painter Jamie Wyeth and published in August 2011. Barbara lives in Maine with her two daughters, husband, and a Tennessee coonhound. I'm Susan Wall, and I've been reading from August Gale by Barbara Walsh. Thank you for listening.